This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Lately, there's been a lot of talk about accelerationism and effective altruism. Doomerism has been in the news for a while. But in particular, with the attempted coup at OpenAI and the firing of several board members, including two of whom were effective altruists, this has brought the conversation about accelerationism back into the conversation. And of course, Sam Altman tweeted, what, I think about a year ago or earlier this year, "No one can out-accelerate me." So we need to talk about how these various ideologies form, why they're important, and how they intersect with technology. So here are some sources for this video. I just want to show that, like, I'm not making this stuff up, and if you want to look into it, go for it. Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, The Status Game by Will Storr, How Family Structure Drives Ideology by the channel What If Alt Hist, America's Freedom is a Lie by Wisecrack, Debt, a New Religion by Wisecrack, and then Seven Emotions That Push the World, also by What If Alt Hist. There's more, but these are probably the most salient, and also that's like, I don't know, 30, 40 hours worth of reading and watching by itself. So, moving right along. First, we need to unpack narratives, tribes, and status games. So when I say a narrative, what I mean by a narrative is just a story or set of stories that we use to make sense of the world. So this is why some of you who've been on the internet for a while might remember the arguments, particularly when atheism was kind of more of a hot topic, where people would say, well, science is just a religion too. And that's not necessarily true, but, you know, people would say, well, you have to take, you know, scientific publications on faith and blah, blah, blah. And what I realized is that actually what they have in common is that they're both narratives. So science is a narrative, religion is a narrative, philosophy is a narrative as well. And what I mean by that is that all of these are conveyed as stories. The history of science is a series of stories that we use to make sense of science, and that's how we use to teach the lessons of science. And in fact, every scientific paper, every publication is a miniature story saying, this is what we did, this is how we did it, and this is the information, these are the conclusions that we came from this little miniature scientific story that I just told you. Likewise, philosophy is very often, certainly the history of philosophy is taught through narratives, through little anecdotes, vignettes, and stories. Likewise, religion is taught the same way. Now, you might say, well, the chief difference is that religion is fictional, that many of the stories, many of the parables are in no way, you know, yes, you can say they're basically myths. It's mythology. But likewise, philosophy is not much different because most of the thought experiments are complete fictions. And so the similarity and difference between philosophy and religion is far narrower than the difference between the narratives of science and religion. But the point is that is how they exist in the human brain. Science does not exist outside of human brains, neither does philosophy and neither does religion. these all exist only by virtue of the fact that they are in human brains, and they are stored as narratives, which is why you can hold multiple versions of reality in your head, because it's your brain doesn't handle it as there is one, you know, one true version of reality. Your brain holds it as a series of narratives. So understanding this is pretty central to the rest of the video. The next concept that you need to be familiar with, and I've mentioned this before, is epistemic tribes. So an epistemic tribe is just a group of people with similar narratives or with shared narratives. And so the simplest example of this is you might say, like, all Protestants have some shared narratives, but it's not even fully true, but that's an example. Likewise, you might say, like, people from Michigan have some shared narratives about Michigan. Americans have shared narratives about America. Capitalists have shared narratives about capitalism. So that's pretty much all you need to know about an epistemic tribe. One thing that I will point out, though, is that many people call them echo chambers, but that is a normative gatekeeping tactic used by the institutional establishment to say, well, we are the arbiters of the only true narrative. We are the dominant epistemic tribe, and therefore we'll pathologize anyone who disagrees with us and just say that's an echo chamber. But this fails to recognize that epistemic tribes are a natural and healthy phenomenon. And epistemic boundaries can break down along any line. You can have linguistic boundaries. So, for instance, you have the English-speaking world, and then you have the Chinese-speaking world, and then you have, the French-speaking world. So epistemic tribes are perfectly natural. There's geographical boundaries as well. So, you know, information tends to stay local until it goes viral on the internet. The internet has really changed our relationship with information. But yeah, so you get the idea. Epistemic tribes are a perfectly natural phenomenon. It's not just boomers on Facebook, which is what this graphic is supposed to represent. So then the third primary phenomenon that you need to understand is status games. So status games is basically the observation, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, is that social status is the primary objective function of the human brain. And there's a lot of the evidence to support this is that when push comes to shove, people will make the choice to elevate their status rather than a lot of material gains. So a piece of evidence of this from the book is that given the option between a new title, a new prestigious title at work, and a raise, people will more often choose the title, something that confers more social status, more than just a basic raise. They want the prestige of the title. And there's literally thousands of examples in the book, but that's just one example. Another thing is that there are objective empirical benefits from having higher social status. And so what I mean by that is that social status is the strongest predictor of longevity, of health, of sexual fitness, of happiness. Like, it predicts pretty much everything good. So more social status is better. Now, within the status game, there are five key principles that he talks about. And there's virtue games, dominance games, and success games, which I'll talk about each of those in just a minute in more detail, because in particular, virtue games are what is at stake here when we're talking about doomerism and accelerationism and all the other dispositions, all the other ideologies around technology. But what I'll conclude with on this slide is that there are tight games and then there are broad games. And so what a tight game is where the game becomes more rigid. The definition of success is more exclusionary. And there's a lot more scrutiny and homogeneity. And I'll give some examples of tight games in just a moment. You are familiar with tight games. You have seen them multiple times throughout history. But then there's also broad games. And so this is the opposite. Basically, when there are multiple paths to success and there's no one true conformance or no one true path, broad games create more inclusivity and are also less violent. So moving on. Success games, this is the most familiar kind of game because particularly in America, we have refined it to an exact science of saying, like, money is good, therefore get more money. That's capitalism in a nutshell. That's neoliberalism in a nutshell. Conspicuous consumption by accumulating wealth, accumulating prestige, buying more property, having a fancy car, social media following. Success is not just money. Having more followers on social media is a way of conspicuously demonstrating success. And this is pretty well known, pretty well established, so I don't need to perseverate on this slide terribly long. Again, you're familiar with this probably. Dominance games, you've also seen this. So it's basically comes down to physical prowess and intimidation and physical dominance and all of the ways that it manifests. In terms of social structures where you see this, law enforcement, sports, athletics, military, at the gym as well, prisons very much engage in dominance games. This is the most primal form of game that we have. So this is, you know, you can see dominance games happening in the animal kingdom, such as between chimps, dolphins, gorillas, so on. And it's about aggression, sexual prowess, physical beauty, and establishing a hierarchy based on very primal tactics and strategies. Again, you've seen this. It's very familiar. There's no mystery here. And then finally, virtue games. You have seen virtue games as well. So virtue games are about prestige and piety or conformance to certain value structures. And this leads to purity testing. It also leads to virtue signaling. But it is also one of the most sophisticated games that we play because it requires a lot of social intelligence, a lot of social political savvy. And also it requires you to remember things about people and concoct and engage with very, very sophisticated narratives. And some of those narratives are very, very complex. So for instance, like the QAnon crowd, that is an example of a virtue game that has a very Byzantine narrative. So the QAnon narrative is a very complex set of stories. Likewise, anti-vaxxers, that is a virtue game that is about a very complex set of narratives. But an example of virtue signaling is the quintessential post of an anti-vaxxer mom saying, "I'm a good mom, so of course I don't vax my baby." And that is an example of virtue signaling. And then the purity testing in those, and I'll go over those in greater detail in just a moment, but purity testing is about basically scrutinizing people to say, are you one of us or not? And purity testing and virtue signaling gets more intense when you have a tight virtue game. So purity testing, the most broad spectrum quintessential example today is cancel culture, which left, right, everyone does cancel culture, and cancel culture is also nothing new. The Spanish Inquisition and burning witches at the stake, that was a form of cancel culture. It is the same exact psychology, which is basically you don't conform to our narrow set of values and standards, therefore you are now expelled from the group. And so like the fact that people that have been canceled on social media, they often lose their livelihood. Some of them lose all their friends, their family, their support. And in the worst cases, they end up killing themselves. And so cancel culture is a modern version of basically burning people at the stake. It is what's called a social level of execution. And so the idea of purity testing is you're constantly looking for things that someone has done wrong in order to discern whether or not you're a member of the group. We've seen this countless times throughout recent history and older history. So the Red Scare and McCarthyism was an example of purity testing. It's how American are you? And of course, you know, China with the social credit system is now working on just making it state policy and doing purity testing on conformance to the CCP's party line, doing it with AI. So this is why purity testing is bad, and purity testing is, well, it's, I'm not going to say that it's always bad, but it is a sign of a tight game, and tight games lead to violence and injustice. And then finally, virtue signaling. This particular one was good to make. Look how inclusive I am. This is superficial and performative demonstrations of your group performance. So virtue signaling, often people will do this in a way to say, they'll do it as cheaply as possible to say, like, look how aligned I am with this ideology. This is in contrast with costly signaling. And so, for instance, an example of costly signaling is going to church every Sunday in order to demonstrate your adherence to the virtues of being a good Christian, because basically you sacrifice an entire day or an entire morning in order to show, look, I am a member of this group and I am conforming to its values. Whereas particularly on the internet, Superficial gestures, such as just, you know, uttering a few catchphrases, is pretty much all you need to do in order to signal your virtues. Now, I don't want to pathologize virtue signaling because, again, when you look at status games and if you understand and accept that social status is part of the human condition, purity testing and virtue signaling are part of it, but they only become pathological when the games tighten to the point that you start wanting to excommunicate and execute people either literally or figuratively. Okay, so now that you have the groundwork, let's talk about some popular examples that are in mainstream American culture today. So on the left, equality is the primary virtue to signal. And so equality is good, therefore more equality is better. And so when you start to look at the fact that the left is emphasizing equality, that's why concepts like universal basic income is popular. And this is also about positive rights. And so what positive rights mean is that's an entitlement. And so if you say like, well, everyone should have a right to education and healthcare and internet and have a right to a job, those are what are called positive rights, which is the government should enforce and ensure and guarantee that you have access to certain things. And this is converse to negative rights, which we'll talk about in just a second. And in the most extreme cases, when the game narrows, you end up doubling down on equality at all costs, including putting the cart before the horse, where you basically draw moral equivalency between all, because any suggestion of inequality becomes taboo, becomes perverse, and is impure. And so when you say equality above all else, you end up making really kind of dumb assertions, such as like, well, men and women are just intrinsically equal at an endogenous level, which is like not provable and demonstrably false. Men are taller. That is something that you can observe. Men are stronger. That is something you can observe. And I'm saying on average. But when you put the principle of equality above all else, you end up having to deny these very obvious facts. Likewise, in the most extreme cases, as we've seen with the recent violence in the Middle East, they purified it to the point where they just say Hamas was justified. And I will say that deliberate rape and murdering children is never justified. I don't care who's doing it. But because we've gotten to the point where equality above all else is the point of the hard left or the radical left, you end up with these really asinine beliefs. And, by the way, no group is safe. On the right, freedom. Freedom is good, therefore more freedom is better. And so you have the idea of equality versus freedom is the primary tension in America, but also all Western cultures. Europe has its own struggles over this. And so when you talk about liberty or individual freedom, this is about negative rights. It's not about entitlement to things. It's about freedom from tyranny, oppression, coercion, government overreach. And so this is why you end up with the thing like taxes are theft, because freedom in an absolute sense means that you don't have any obligations to anyone. But of course, that is an extreme version of that principle of freedom taken to an absolute extreme, especially if you value freedom to the exclusion of equality. And so this is the fundamental tension, again, in all Western liberal societies of what is the balance of equality versus freedom. But because we're in such a polarized period of time, people take both to extremes. And so this is where you see libertarian, ideology saying like, just get rid of the government altogether, get rid of taxes altogether. And these are extreme positions that are completely indefensible. They don't make logical sense. There's no historical precedent for it. But because they have doubled down on these principles of freedom at all costs to the exclusion of all else, you end up with really extreme ideologies. Just the same that on the left, if you put equality above all else and to the exclusion of all else, you end up with really extreme ideologies. Conservatism is tradition above all else. Tradition is good, therefore more tradition is better. And I've literally had people tell me women ought to know their place. So the story behind this was I was driving back from the mountains and I was at a gas station and there was a woman struggling with the gas pump and she came in to get help from the gas station attendant. And he just looked at me after she left and he's like, women shouldn't be allowed to drive. And I was just like, wow, what century is this? But again, tradition does have its value. But if you double down on tradition for tradition's own sake and you put that to the exclusion of all else, you end up with really asinine backwards beliefs. I think you get the idea. Progressivism is change for the sake of all change. So change is good, therefore more change is better. This quotation was actually said to me by a friend in high school. She said we should lower the standards so that more people can be firefighters if they want to. And no, the physical requirements to be a firefighter are there for a reason. You don't want someone who weighs 110 pounds trying to pull you out of a burning building. So again, when you double down on the idea that maybe change is good and therefore more change is better, and you become a hardliner or you take that to an extreme, you end up saying really things that are completely indefensible because you have doubled down on a single principle. And then finally, religion. So most religious people are fine. Oh, and one thing that I need to say is what I'm talking about here are the extremes. I'm not talking about the reasonable people. Reasonableness is on a bell curve. Most people are reasonable. What I'm talking about in all of these cases is any ideology taken to an extreme. So I just need to say that because, like, just because someone is religious doesn't mean they're a crusader. So, however, there have been periods of times where games have narrowed and you end up with things like crusaders. Jesus said, love thy neighbor and, you know, tolerate and turn the other cheek. But then you also get crusaders, which doesn't make a damn bit of sense. But this is the principle of God is good, particularly my God, therefore more God is better. The Romans felt much the same way, and the fact that that the Roman Catholic Church evolved from the Roman Empire, it really kind of makes sense why the Roman Catholic Church is the way that it, or at least was the way that it was. Deus vult, God wills it. So you see the pattern here. Something is good, therefore more of something is better. This is the universal pattern of all extreme ideologies. Now, let's talk about composite identities. So at the beginning, I talked about epistemic tribes. Most people are, well, everyone is a member of multiple epistemic tribes. I am a white American of Jewish ancestry who lives on the East Coast, who is, you know, blah, 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 blah. Someone watching this, I know that I have a global audience. Some of you might be Hindu, some of you might be Catholic, some of you might be whatever, right? Like, there's all kinds of people from all over the world. And when people have a healthy, well-rounded set of epistemic tribes that they are a member of and are not doubling down on each one, that is how you avoid extremism. And so if you have a singular identity where your identity is entirely wrapped up in a single epistemic tribe and everyone you know is wrapped up in a single epistemic tribe, that is what leads to extremism. And so a well-rounded person is someone who is a member of generally around five or more epistemic tribes. And so if you say, like, well, I'm a white guy, I'm white, I'm a man, I'm an American, that's three right there. And that's before even getting into, like, my preferences. Like, I identify with technology, I identify with a bunch of other stuff. And so the more well-rounded you are, the more epistemic tribes you are a member of, and also the more nuance you are required to have, because some of those tribal identities are going to be in tension with each other. However, if you use purity testing and virtue signaling to eliminate all tension, to eliminate all nuance, that is how you get to purified extremism. So now let's talk about technological ideologies, because these are no different from any other ideology. Doomerism. AI is going to kill us all. So the idea here is that doom is inevitable, therefore more doom is better. And the idea is that this is a principle that people double down on, and it becomes a virtue game where you have to virtue signal around how much you believe in P-Doom. Just because, like, okay, people by and large agree that, like, the chance of catastrophe is between 1 and 50%, but some people say, ah, well, I'm going to double down on this and say that it's 99% certain, or that it's almost certain, or that it's absolutely inevitable. And so this is an example of purity testing and virtue signaling that leads to doomerism. And so when your entire social status is wrapped up in this doomerist ideology and you have no other epistemic tribes to counterbalance you, you end up just doubling down and you say, okay, well, optimism is actually bad. Like, if you pathologize something that is not congruent in the same way that that leftists demonize and pathologize any form of inequality, including earned privileges or, you know, endogenous privileges, like you're supposed to be ashamed of anything, any advantage that you have, according to the left, because equality above all else and inequality is bad. Likewise, with doomerism, you inevitably must pathologize any form of optimism, and you say those people are delusional. And we've heard this, we've seen this. And so then it's like, anything other than acceptance of our inevitable catastrophe and our inevitable downslide towards extinction or worse, that is why these people are incentivized to seemingly hope and pray for something that is going to be abjectly miserable for themselves, and even to avoid talking about solutions or antidotes. Utopianism. Perfection is attainable, resistance is futile. I don't think I have to talk about this much more, but the idea that that there is an idealized perfect state that you can reach for, that's not necessarily a good idea, because one person's definition of utopia is going to be different from everyone else's definition. And the Borg from Star Trek are an example of achieving that perfect state, that perfect society at all costs. Because according to the Borg, a perfect society is one with no disharmony whatsoever, where everyone is homogenous, everyone is treated equal, and everyone is 100% collectivist. And so, you know, your biological and technological distinctiveness will be added to our own. I say this as someone who is myself a utopianist. So I am aware of the tension here, but I, as a member of multiple epistemic tribes, I am aware of the problems of taking that particular ideology to an extreme. And so I temper my definition of utopia as high social mobility, high individual liberty, and high standard of living. I feel like that's a pretty reasonable definition of utopia. But again, I am aware that if I were to distill that identity into a pure form, it would basically be the Borg. And then finally, accelerationism. Technology is good, therefore more technology is better. This leads to really silly statements like you can't out-accelerate me, because again, if technology is good and more technology is better and you double down on this, you end up saying, well, maybe nothing else matters. And so this is also called techno-optimism. But the thing here is, if you believe in this, then that means you inevitably have to pathologize people who are advocating for safety, people who maybe are skeptical of technology. And so when you have to, again, it's about that dichotomy. It's whatever you optimize for, you have to pathologize the opposite if you become an extreme. And so again, the assertion that technology is good, therefore more technology is better, this is an eminently defensible position, which is why I understand accelerationists, is because, yes, like I am someone who used to unironically say the only thing that has increased the standard of living for people is technology. Politics, economics, none of those things in the grand scheme of things has increased our quality of life. The fact that I'm able to sit here and record a video on my computer, on the internet, and play video games and do other things, that's all due to technology. The fact that I am alive right now is due to medical technology, because there have been several things in my life that would have killed me without medical technology. And most of you watching actually probably wouldn't be alive right now to watch this without medical technology and medical advancements over the last century. Why? Because we would have died of tuberculosis or polio or, you know, staph infection or whatever. And so, yes, technology is good, therefore more technology is better. It is an eminently defensible belief. However, when it gets purified and you say more technology at all costs and everyone who disagrees with me is wrong or insane or whatever, that is when it becomes pathological. That is when it becomes an extremist ideology. And so then incrementalism. So this is deliberation and cautiousness is good, therefore more deliberation and cautiousness is better. Again, this is kind of like whatever gets someone the most social status in their particular epistemic tribe. So I picked Dr. Roman Chowdhury, who is a big voice in caution and deliberation. I happen to agree with her because, again, I am a member of multiple epistemic tribes and I'm not doubling down on any one. I agree with pretty much all of these all of these ideologies that I've talked about. So, like, what I mean is, like, yes, there is the potential for catastrophe. I'm one who talks about terminal race conditions as one of the most dangerous things that could threaten us, but I'm not going to keep saying that until I get on the TED stage. Likewise, I do want to see a utopian future, but I'm not going to say let's do this at all costs. And then technology is good, therefore more technology is better. Yes, I agree with this, but not to the exclusion of all else. And likewise, caution is good, but not to the exclusion of all else. So, what are the general principles that we can extract from this? First, radical narratives are bad. People that are calling for a reimagining of society or a radical restructuring of society, that is an extremist ideology. And I picked the French Revolution to represent this because while we valorize the French Revolution in hindsight, it was extremely destructive and extremely bloody and extremely terrifying. We don't want to repeat that. And there have been other radical restructurings of society throughout the world. Soviet communism, the People's Revolution in China, the American Revolution, the American Civil War. Whenever someone calls for a radical restructuring of society and that happens, it is very bloody and a lot of people lose. And so I want to caution against any radical narratives, technological or otherwise. This is a universal pattern. Whether it's the woke left or the MAGA right, all of this is about that same pattern of X is good, therefore more X is better. I've already kind of driven this point home, so I don't think I need to perseverate on this. But this pattern has existed across all of time and space for the entire, the entire globe and the entire history of humanity. This pattern keeps emerging. This is why you had the Salem witch trials. This is why you had the Spanish Inquisition. This is why you had the Crusades, is when a game tightens and you end up with too much purity testing and too much virtue signaling, you end up with extremism and you end up doubling down on a single principle. X is good, therefore more X is better. Dual use. One of the key things about technology, and this is a hardcore, unassailable truth, is that all technology is dual use. So an example is fissile material. You can use it to make nuclear weapons. You can also use it to make nuclear power plants. Very powerful technology, either way you slice it, it is dual use. Artificial intelligence is no different. Some of you probably saw the news broke yesterday that the Pentagon is going full tilt towards autonomous AI-based weapons that will have discretion to use lethal force without humans in the loop. AI is dual use. So when someone like Sam Altman says AGI is going to make the world an infinitely better place and completely ignores the fact that AI could also be used as a tool of tyranny and oppression, that is a single-minded view. Synthetic biology, likewise, there's medications out there that we can take. There's all kinds of things that emerge from the same technology that created the COVID pandemic. So you can use synthetic biology to cure diseases or make new ones. This is a hardcore, unassailable fact. But again, some people kind of double down on one side or the other. So what do I call myself? Tongue in cheek, I say I'm a Carlinist realism. This is George Carlin, who was a comedian. He said, "Inside every cynic is a disappointed idealist." I'm not going to spend too much time on this. I just thought it was funny, so I included it near the end. But the conclusion here is acceleration and doomerism, they're two sides of the same coin. They are extreme versions of these ideologies that I talked about that have just doubled down on a very narrow principle. And the game is still presently narrowing because the stakes are high and they're getting higher. So that's one of the key things that you need to know is that's what makes these games narrow or tighten, is when the stakes go up. And so, for instance, during wartime, the stakes go up. And so what it means to be a good American becomes a very narrow definition when we're at war, when every nation is at war. In both cases, for the two polar opposites, accelerationism and doomerism, both of these are rooted in fictional foundations, just like how anti-vaxxers and flat earthers rooted in fictional narratives. The idea that humanity is gonna be wiped out by AI, there has been zero evidence that I am aware of, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but that any of the frontier models that we're talking about want to eradicate humanity. I haven't seen any evidence of it. So where are they getting this idea? They're using their imagination to get this idea. Likewise, when Sam Altman and other people say AGI is gonna make everything infinitely better, there's not really any evidence of that yet, except for the principle that technology is good, therefore more technology is better. Yes, AI is helping in many ways, but it can also hurt in a lot of ways. There are winners and losers. in these status games, and if you view accelerationism and doomerism not as anchored to the technology or anything in the real world, if you just view them as virtue games, as status games, there are people that win, the ones that end up getting on the TED stage, for instance. But there are real consequences to these virtue games. And so what I mean by that is look at the fact that, McCarthyism, the satanic panic, these are all examples of virtue games that had very real consequences for people. Burning witches at the stake has very real consequences for people. Cancel culture has very real consequences for people. So we want to avoid having a narrowing set of virtue games or status games, because that is what leads to extremism, and that's what leads to violence and injustice. So thanks for watching. I hope you got a lot out of this. I know that this was probably a very spicy take, but I think that it is time to advance this narrative and talk about some of these things as primarily human phenomenon, social phenomenon. And as many of you have said and pointed out, aligning humans is the hard part. Aligning machines was never going to be the hard part. It was always aligning humanity was the hard part. And that's what this video is about. Cheers.